Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Canis Albinus,
Makalua,
the Mean Team,
Mega Bears Fan.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Polycast number 377. I am a co-host, Canis Albinus, and I am joined with our regulars, Makalua.
My hockey team won 7-0 last night, but I can't be exactly proud of that because they could have just stopped killing them while they were dead.
The Mean Team.
In with the new, out with the old military equipment.
And Mega Bears Fan.
Sticking with sports, the Bears did in fact embarrass themselves on national television in the playoffs.
Again?
They almost won.
Not as much as Nashville got embarrassed by the Dallas Stars last night.
Is it as big as an embarrassment as what happened with the Falcons at the Super Bowl?
No, that was still wrong.
That was actually a close game, but the way it was a close game was what made that bad.
It was not a close game at halftime. That was the problem.
Yeah.
That went from close to nope really fast.
Yeah, that one was bad. That was bad.
It was quite possibly the funniest thing that happened to the internet that week, though.
Got new civilizations, and one of them is Nam. So Vietnam is interesting. You get good movement through the jungle. You get Stampy in a new form, and you get district limitations, but they're better when you can place them. And also, you get to replace them the best districts in the game. So pretty good.
Limitations on district placement seems to be a running theme in this New Frontiers DLC pass.
Well, yeah, you're on the frontier after all.
That does make sense.
Yeah, changing the way that people or players settle their cities and develop them seems to have been a large focus of this particular set of DLC.
Yeah, they're trying to shake up our normal, just plop this here, plop that there. Now you got to think just a little harder.
Yeah, get people out of their comfort zones.
Yeah.
So the specific reading for these events, for these abilities is land specialty districts can only be built on woods, rainforests, or marshes, and they have little icons next to them, which I assume means they get bonuses based on which one of those they're placed on. And they don't remove those features. Buildings within those districts receive extra bonuses, and you can plant woods at medieval fairs.
Now, can you build any of the districts on any of the features, or was it like you have to build a campus on rainforest, and you have to build a holy site on forest, or something like that?
That is not clear to me.
Yeah, I don't think we know that yet, but I'm just sitting here thinking about a campus buried deep into rainforest and going,
It's already one civ stick when it comes to campuses.
Yeah, but also not taking... with any of the districts, not taking what's underneath them, so you've still got whatever bonus is there, whether that's a little bit of extra production or a little bit of extra food or what have you, which will add up.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Also, the ability to plant forests is interesting.
It's a lot earlier.
Yeah.
It is worth noting that you cannot re-chop the forest and get yield from it again, so anybody who's thinking that, at least that's currently the case with the planting woods feature that's available late in the game, so I'm assuming it's also with Vietnam.
The question is, when you plant a woods in Medieval Fairs era, does that mean it becomes an old growth forest by the time conservation rolls around? Or is it still a second growth forest?
I would have to assume it's second growth, because yeah, otherwise you'd just be planting them and then chopping them down and rushing stuff left and right. I mean, unless it does take, like, several eras for it to be considered, is there any point in the game where second growth becomes old growth, like, already? Because I wasn't aware of that, if that was the case.
I don't think so. I don't think the time that you realize that it's a second growth forest or an old growth forest means that there's not enough time left for it to grow all the way. And under normal circumstances, you can't plant woods after the beginning of the game. So,
yeah, I guess we won't know until it actually comes out, but I would have to assume that you cannot do that. And I also would have to assume that you can put any district on any of the features, because otherwise, like, depending on the map, you just wouldn't be able to place certain districts. And that would suck.
Yeah.
Right, like, imagine starting out in the, like, tundra, where you're as far away from rainforest as possible, and you can just never place a campus.
For the unique unit, it is a crossbow. I could not find what the name of this crossbow is, because it's not written anywhere in the first few pages of Red, and I only got to page 5. So all I know is it's a crossbow replacement, about the same strength. It has 3 moves, and it can move after attacking, and it has +1 sight, costs a little more. Also, you're on the back of an elephant, which is the stampy.
So it's like the Sabum Kibitum from Babylon, but on an elephant and with a crossbow.
And being able to move after attacking.
Oh, yeah, that too.
That's a really good ability. I mean, you just have it.
Yeah, especially with 3 moves.
Step back.
Yeah.
And I think, like, just their leader or civ ability is, like, not being slowed down by forest and rainforest, right?
I don't know if that's true. I know that it's you get a +1 movement if you're starting the turn on those terrains.
Oh, okay.
From the video, they move through the forest and rainforest really quickly.
Yeah.
So I would imagine they're not taking penalties in addition to getting the movement speed bonus.
Yeah, I don't remember specifically, but the video definitely made it look like there was some kind of movement bonus in forests and woods.
If you own the territory, the bonus is doubled. Also, if you are in rainforest, woods, and marsh, you get a +5 combat strength,
so if,
which is also doubled in owned territory.
So if the elephant crossbow starts in Vietnamese territory on woods tiles, it has 5 movement?
Yes.
That is a very fast elephant.
That's going to be a hell of a surprise attack, too.
Yeah. Get out of the way!
Add a great general to that, and it's +6, and it's a 6 movement.
Oh, yeah, true.
I don't have any units near your borders. Oops, wait, my units are in your borders. Uh-huh.
Shoot, they're at your capital.
Oops, where'd your capital go?
And I assume it's still range 2 on its attack?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, it's already powerful enough to give me a more range.
Well, I was thinking...
Strike, though.
I was thinking since it can move faster, maybe they made it a range 1, so you move in, attack at range 1, and then move out.
That might have been a better idea for a balance, but who cares about balance?
Hey, gotta sell these things somehow.
Sometimes it's just fun to have fun.
The leader is... Who is the leader this time? We haven't mentioned her name yet.
Oh, I forget her name.
Somebody's linked it as Lady Trio? Trio? I'm not sure how to pronounce Vietnamese.
I can usually get languages, but Vietnamese is further beyond my capability.
Yeah, not named has quoted it that she's from the Three Kingdoms period. So, I was talking about some other stuff in there, but that's where she's from. But there was something about the storm part of it that was in there, that there was a battle where, similar to the one I think that was with Japan where their fleet got smashed, except in this case it was something to do with a war in Vietnam. It was a Chinese fleet that got smashed, I think. It was trying to attack Vietnam.
Oh, we'll talk about the Chinese in just a minute. A unique unit, I finally found it. Voi Xian. And then the unique district, which we were talking about earlier, the Sands. It is a replacement encampment that gives +2 culture per adjacent district, and it does not count as a specialty district, so it doesn't require population to build, and you can build it anywhere.
I think Phil approves.
Yeah, because you'll be able to, you can sit down in an encampment anytime you want to, and then you can just, like, build all your other districts around it in the appropriate kind of terrains. Like, you can have that campus and holy sites out in the rainforest or something like that with the encampment right adjacent to it. You might even, if there was a square on the other side, you might even be able to squeeze an industrial zone next to it later, and or your cultural, like your theater square. So,
Nine Dragon River Delta is the district thing. All specialty districts can only be built on rainforest, marsh, and woods. They receive the following yields for every building based on the features. +1 culture for woods, +1 science for rainforest, and +1 production for marsh. Woods can be planted with the Medieval Fairs Civic.
Okay, that was where I got the idea that the each district was feature-specific, because the yields, they were bonus yields that were feature, or feature-specific. That was my confusion.
Also, the Boeotian elephants are stronger when defending, whatever that means.
I guess either a bonus on defense or higher melee combat strength than a regular crossbow?
Probably. Vietnamese lady is named Ba Trio. Ba Trio? It's one of those letters that has an upside-down U on top of the E and a dot underneath it, so I have no idea what that means based on my American education.
Yeah, we don't even know what those accent marks are called, let alone how to pronounce them.
Wow.
We get a lot of European culture and not much Asian culture when we're in school.
Hey,
it's
people
not so much that we don't get Asian culture, it's that we don't get Southeast Asian culture.
We get
quite a bit of Japanese stuff.
Yeah, and China, but there's a Southeast Asia, what? Despite the fact that we talk about spice trade and things?
Part of it has to do with the fact that Vietnam was kind of a taboo subject for a while in our culture.
Well, coming out of the United States schooling system, you know, we still have a lot of people struggling with I before E except after C, so
that's an English thing, though. English is just hard.
Well, right, but the point is we can't even get our own dang language right, so let alone ones from around the world.
Yeah.
I just want to say that this serif, although they were emphasizing other things, seems like it was very well constructed for military, and not just defensive military.
Yeah, you can kind of go in and squish people really easily.
Yeah, I mean, you've got early unique units, easily attainable, better than average encampments, and moving through some of the most annoying terrain for units early on, before, like, roads are a thing and all that. So, like, this is a setup that'll you fight well all game. Now, they're not, like, top tier, like, running through everyone with Macedonia or whatever, but they are a good military civ, too.
Well, and it seems like it's a very flexible civ as well, because the fact that the unique encampment district does not cost a population means that you don't have to choose between getting out that encampment or getting out, you know, another commercial hub for a trade route. You know, you can do both. There's, like, no opportunity cost other than just the time it takes to build the thing. And, as if I recall correctly, they're dirt cheap, too. Like, they're, like, half the cost of a regular district or something. I think they made a special point, though, in this video that, like, the Vietnamese encampment district is, like, even cheaper than a normal unique district. Maybe I misunderstood. So, yeah, you get to do military and also do whatever else you want to do. And get those out really early.
And if your military stuff grinds to a halt and you have to go into the later game, you've already got so many districts that are set up to start you on the snowball roll with both culture and science. So
are we ready to move on to China?
Sort of China? Kind of China? Kublai Khan is it? Mongol China? Kublai Khan? Which was corrected in us talking beforehand. No. It's Genghis that set up the postal service to China, not Kublai. But from what we can
see, Kublai Khan did set up the post office in China, but Genghis started the post offices everywhere else.
Okay.
So Kublai Khan did add post offices in China because he was the one who conquered a lot of China, so.
Slightly backwards. Sorry, I hadn't had my coffee yet.
Really?
Well, at that point when we were talking about that, I hated it,
Yay, coffee!
For my very popular pick from everybody, everybody was expecting if we, you know, of Civ, we have had more than one leader before in previous Civ games. This is one of the ones that we've seen before, and it was kind of like, could we? But the thing is, we don't have, other than we know he's going to be, I think, what do we know? He's going to be great with some trade routes and things like that, and I don't think there was much else we saw in those initial videos. And they haven't done the first look yet.
Yeah, we expect to see that this coming week.
After we record, as usual.
Well, hey, we got 2/3 of the stuff already. You can't complain about that.
Oh, not even just a little bit.
Well, I guess we can't, but...
But yeah, he's another leader who gets to be leader of two different civs. So that's always fun and interesting, seeing how the leader plays differently with the different civs and their unique powers and units. Let's see, what was China's... China's unique ability was the Wonder Building one, or was it...
I think that's Quang Chi Huang.
Yeah.
I think his ability is he gets extra Eurekas. Eureka percentage.
Okay, so China's ability was the Eureka one?
I think so, yes.
Okay.
The one where you get 10% more science per Eureka.
And what was the Mongol civilization's ability in Civ 6?
That's a good question.
I want to say it had something to do with horse or mounted units.
I'm looking it up.
But it wasn't the double unit, because that was a Scythia thing.
Yeah. Civ ability, or two, sending a trade route immediately upon creating a trading post, immediately creates a trading post in the destination city instead of when the trade route is completed. Gain an extra level of diplomatic visibility with civilizations that have a Mongolian trading post. +6 combat units for all units for each level of diplomatic visibility Mongolia has over the other civilization, instead of the usual +3.
Okay, so Mongolia already had the trade route bonus, so I guess Kublai is going to make it better?
Yeah, because it's quoted from the, I think from the video, is trade route, Eureka, and inspiration boost. So instead of, I guess instead of getting the trading post, we're going to get where... We're going to get the Eureka?
Well, it sounds like it would be in addition to getting the trading post, because that's a Mongolian ability, so then Kublai's leader ability would stack on top of that. Or maybe what they meant was you get the trade route bonus from Mongolia, you get a Eureka bonus from China, and then you maybe get an inspiration bonus from Kublai Khan, so maybe he's a culture-oriented leader?
Find out Tuesday how much of this we're wrong about.
Yeah, we're all just pulling stuff out of our butts here. We have no clue.
It'd be a little odd to emphasize culture of Kublai Khan.
Oh, Zander's like, in here on the thread.
Top thing.
Was speculating that the bonuses is get the free Eureka or inspiration when sending a trade route to each civilization for the first time. Possibly, but there's only so many civs of the game. I also wonder if it could be per city. That would be a little too much, though, wouldn't it?
That'd be crazy. If it was per city, it would be ridiculously
Yeah, that would be a little out of whack.
Or it could be, like, each time you complete a, the trade post thing, in which case that would work really well with playing him as the Mongolian leader, because you'd get those faster.
Yeah, the direction people are going, I think it's the first time in the Civ, and maybe it's not when you do the route initially, but when you get that trading post, and whether you have to wait, with Kublai, whether you have to wait until that's completed. Like, you've completed the entire trade route first. Also pointed out from a screenshot, they were getting extra faith even though they didn't have a holy site anywhere.
That could come from trade routes, too.
Yeah.
Or from the... Wasn't there a pantheon that gives faith per pastures?
I remember there being one that gave culture for pastures, unless they buffed it to also give faith. I remember sometime last year they did do rebalancing for a lot of pantheons, including, I think, adding faith to some that had previously only given other yields. So maybe the pasture one now is culture and faith. It's been a while since I've used it.
It's hard to be sure, though. I kind of find it hilarious that China has a second leader that's actually the conqueror of China rather than one of the Chinese leaders.
Hey, it is kind of funny. Wonder how that's going to sell in China.
I mean, I really don't care, but I don't know. It seems like an odd choice if you're trying to go for the Chinese market. Then again, maybe they don't consider him to be a conqueror. I don't know.
Well, I mean, but that's true. Like, you can argue that Julius Caesar being the leader of Rome is a conqueror of Rome. So, I mean, it is a different thing, but...
But he was Roman, though, to start with.
Yeah, true.
That was a civil war as opposed to a conquering power from somebody else.
True. I think
It's more like Alexander being the leader of Greece is kind of weird because he conquered Greece.
Yeah, and I feel like India has also had leaders like that in past civilization games where it was actually like a Muslim conqueror of India or something like that and not actually an Indian. I could be wrong about that, though, misremembering.
No, there's never been a Muslim conqueror of India to my knowledge.
Or maybe it was just a leader who converted...
They had Ashoka, sort of like that,
yeah.
But...
That's probably who I'm thinking of, then, and just getting the history wrong.
This is why we need Moogles, by the way.
Because then... What is it EU4?
Because then there would not be a Moogle ruler leading India. He could properly lead the Moogles.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was thinking of, yeah.
But Sid has never put a Moogle leader in India, to my knowledge.
Oh, I thought they did at one point.
No, they had the Mughal fort as, like, a unique
building
put into five, but which, again, is a little awkward. But you can at least, like, say, okay, well, I mean, it is Gandhi leading it. The Mughal forts are probably still there, But it's a little odd for Gandhi to be building Mughal forts, whatever.
We don't play this game for historical accuracy.
That's like the USA having, like, Native American stuff. It's, like, come on now. We're not going for historical accuracy. We're going for, like, a nod to the actual civilizations which have the stuff.
What, you mean Kanye West can't build totem poles for a cultural thing?
I mean, I wouldn't tell him no to his face, but it would be a little strange.
That's right, the man did survive getting shot and then finished a speech before going to the hospital.
Yeah.
Alright, so yes, so in addition to getting new leader for China, we are also getting a new game mode, which is a return, but in a different way, of the corporations game mode. So, the way I understood that this works is you build, like, special improvements over certain luxury resources, and then you get, like, extra bonuses from them, or you convert them into some kind of manufactured good that you can then sell or trade. Something like that. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, it looks like it was almost a workshop type of place, like a specialty workshop, like only for refining sugar workshop or something like that. And then once you got a monopoly...
Yeah, and the big point was that you actually get, like, additive bonuses for having more of a specific luxury instead of just getting two, so you have one for you and one to sell. You know, you actually want to explore and expand to get more of the same luxuries that you already have, and then eventually if you have a monopoly on them, do you get some kind of, like, actual game bonus for having a monopoly, or is it just the fact that you get to sell them? I don't know.
You get bonuses for it, yeah. So let's see if we can figure out, based on this collection of screenshots of bread, figure out how this is put together. So you get two, if you have two of one resource, you can build an industry improvement on top of, which is a builder improvement. And this gives a specific yield based on what the actual thing is. So for diamond industry, it looks like plus 25% gold in the host city. And later on, you can build the corporation improvement with a great merchant, which lets you name your corporation. And when you create your corporation, create a project in city that lets you create a great work called a product. Product? Yes, a product. And those products go into stock exchanges through the Great Works menu.
Or harbors.
Or harbors, do they?
I think they have four harbors, yeah.
Yeah.
Presumably one of the buildings in the harbor, not just the harbor district.
Looks like seaports.
Yeah, or shipyards.
And the one they showed the example of here is a coffee product, and it gives plus 20% culture use in the city. And once you get a certain percentage control of the market, i.e. control this many resources, you get monopoly. Monopoly gives gold based on the percentage control and trading partner plus grants tourism bonus.
So I like that this does not sound like it's basically just a reskin of the religion mechanic, as was the case, I think, with the corporations in Civ 4.
Yeah, this is something different because you're having to corral. You know, you're going to have to move the great works around. You're going to have to do different things with trading. You're going to have to expend more worker time to improve those from the simple, like, gathering things into the ones that will eventually form the corporation.
The corporation is an upgrade to an industry, and it uses the great merchant.
So we will also have other uses for the great merchant than sitting there and just getting more trade routes or getting an extra envoy or whatever bonuses.
Yeah, some of those merchants are really good, though. It's going to be tough to decide whether you want to use their regular power or build a corporation with them. Like, I would have to assume that having a corporation is probably going to be better than increasing my trade route capacity, but it's still like, oh, man, improving my trade route capacity is still also a really good thing. Like,
yeah.
Tough decisions.
That's the theme of all the stuff in the Frontier Path, basically.
Yeah.
Well, there's some other stuff that was added. We get the Preserve building, which is added in the DLC. It's a unique tile, or a tile improvement that unlocked...
Wait, was it an improvement or a district?
I
was under the impression it was a district, because you can actually build buildings on it.
I sometimes get tile improvement and district just when I'm talking.
Okay, fair enough.
It grants three housing based on appeal, culture bombs neutral tiles, and has plus one appeal adjacent. Cannot be built next to the city center. You get to build two buildings in it. There's the Grove, which is plus one food and plus one faith per adjacent unimproved charming tiles. Plus two food, plus two faith, plus two culture for adjacent unimproved breathtaking tiles. And then you get the Sanctuary, which is unlocked at Conservation, plus one Science and plus one Gold added to the Grove's benefits for Charming Tiles, and plus two Science, plus two Gold, plus two Production to adjacent unimproved Breathtaking Tiles. So basically, it looks like it's a completely useless thing, because why would you want improved tiles?
Well, I guess it's good early in the game before you've had the opportunity to improve those tiles.
Or if you're expanding out and you're going into undeveloped country things and you know you're not going to have time to fully improve those like you might do your core cities or something. If you're playing a Terra map and you went to the New World.
Yes, I wonder how it interacts with national park thing.
Yeah, you'd think there would be a strong interaction there.
I use the national parks a lot for land that I don't do anything with, because they give a lot of tourism bonus, and culture is kind of my most preferred victory type, because they don't have to do all the unit micromanagement.
Yeah.
Well, and it sounds like the sanctuary or the preserve, like, you would put in the same places that you would have put a national park previously, because you want it to be surrounded by, you know, charming and breathtaking tiles. So, but then the downside is building that in that place would eventually block you from building a national park there, which, you know, may be something that you would rather have at that spot, especially if, like you said, you're going for the tourism victory. And I'm surprised that in all the yields that you mentioned, I didn't hear you say that the preserve generates any tourism. Like, you'd think that's one of the things it would do late game.
It provides a plus one appeal adjacent, I guess, which is the closest it gets.
Yeah, and I guess there's stuff later that converts culture to tourism, so I guess it would eventually get some from that as well, but...
Or it creates tourism from appeal, I think.
Yeah.
Is that a thing you can do? I think it's a thing.
So yeah, it seems like a weird thing. I'm not quite sure what the use for it would be, other than it basically being like an early game national park. And it would be civ-specific. I guess the Maori are really going to like it.
Mm.
I guess it could be good if you have beautiful tiles. Like, it's probably good for Australia.
Yeah, Australia and Maori would definitely be two examples of civs that would like this district.
But it's a district, though, which means it has a population cost.
Well, but is it a specialty district? Is it one of the is it considered like an engineering district that doesn't have the population cost, like the aqueduct and the dam and the canal?
Good question. Does not say.
I would have to assume that it does not cost a population, because, like, I mean, like, just thinking about it, and maybe this is, of course, the wrong way to think about it, we might talk about this more in the next topic, but you don't have people living in a nature preserve, typically. So... why would it require population to build, you know?
Good point.
But, like I said, that could be just a totally wrong way of thinking about it.
I think it's an okay thing, way of thinking about it.
Who put realism in my Civ game, dang it?
I have been trying to find that quote from a long time ago. It was on Polycast, I want to say in the first season, where somebody said that civilization is really good at being a good game, but it is really terrible at being a history game, because everything is basically ripped apart and shoved together in a way that makes no sense historically.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about, you know, random collections of civilizations and leaders on procedurally generated maps. I mean, what the heck do you expect?
I once saw a civ referred to as a Whiggish view of history. It's all because progress is inevitable.
Yep. Well, and even just the scaling, I mean, like, even on you play a real Earth map, you know, as even a country like Russia or America or Canada that has all this land area, you're still building, like, five cities, you know, in the entire space. So...
yeah.
Civ was never meant to be a historic simulation. You know, it always had the educational elements of learning about these leaders and cultures and, you know, military history associated with their units, but not actually necessarily putting them in practice. If you want to do that, you should probably go be playing Paradox's games.
Even then, careful, not exactly most historically accurate either.
Or Total War or Old World.
Remember that time when Finland invaded the Soviet Union and killed like 200,000 troops by going behind the front line and driving all the way from Moscow to Rostov? Aw, man. Away right now.
Is that the Hearts of Iron?
That was something that happened. There's an achievement for defeating the Soviet Union in Finland, which, as you can imagine, is quite a tall order. And the Mian team did it by basically forcing the Soviets to attack until they had no more equipment, and then, you know, took them apart little bit by little bit.
I suppose that would be the way to do it.
In this thread started by Anon Zain, whatever. I can't pronounce that.
Anon X Anemone.
That makes more sense, actually. We have a thread called Historical Concepts Translated to Gameplay and Mechanics. What are some gameplay and mechanics that represent history concepts well? Are there any concepts that should be implemented, or if already implemented, should be better? And this thread had some interesting stuff going on. There was a lot of plaint in the early part of the thread about how Eurocentric is, to which I say, Eurocentric as it's an American game. Sorry.
Yeah, if it had been developed like anywhere over in Asia, it would be Asian-centric, and that would be what you would expect.
Yeah. Kind of my resistance to revisionist history kind of flares its ugly head in this thread because, you know, we've called it something for hundreds of years. Let's keep calling it that because that's what people... But then it kind of devolves into picking on Bethesda because bugs. And then there's some complaint about the barbarians. But the question I wanted to ask was, is there anything in Civ that isn't there, that should be, or that is there and should be represented differently? And the biggest one that comes to my mind is pandemics, even though they're kind of a...
I was
going to
say the same thing, because we had that...
Kind of a hot topic right now, but...
Yeah, because we had the health in Civ 4, and if you had unhealthy cities, and there were, I think, a couple of plague events in Civ 4 as well, and that's historically, there were things like the Black Plague and other things that riddle through civilizations and really crippled them.
Yeah, I always felt like the health mechanic in Civ 4 was kind of a very underdeveloped, underutilized mechanic, though, because it really, it didn't really do all that much, because aside from, like, a couple of random events that you mentioned in the Beyond the Sword expansion, it didn't trigger plague events, you know, in vanilla Civ 4, at least. But also, just, like, it kind of solved its own problem, because all it did was stop growth, you know?
That's what it was designed to do.
Yeah, it was
just a check on growth.
Yeah, it was just a check on growth alongside city happiness, and it didn't really do all that much beyond that, other than, you know, random events popping up in, like I said, the second expansion.
As much as we complained about it at the time, we are lacking something like that here. I mean, I guess it's sort of folded into housing in a certain extent, because, you know,
right,
like an aqueduct gives you housing, although in real life, aqueduct gave you fresh water.
Yeah, the idea is that the fresh water from the aqueduct gives you the fresh water to sustain more people living in your city, thus promoting population growth. So it's just, it's there, but it's like two levels of abstraction.
Yeah.
I guess it's kind of abstractly added to the Great Ages mechanic, because one could easily argue that a dark age caused by a pandemic. One could also argue that a great age, that a golden age is caused by a pandemic, because that's kind of how the Renaissance started. A large part of it was because there was less population in Europe because of the Black Death, so they needed the ways to get stuff done.
Well, but also just, like, trying to figure out why all these people are getting sick and dying, like, helped promote, you know, greater scientific literacy and experimentation.
And disapproval of the church, also.
Is it demons, or do people just need to wash their hands more?
Yeah, the church ain't fixing this. This has been going on for hundreds of years now. Maybe we should science this thing up.
The only thing about it being tied with the ages is... I don't know, it's still too abstract in that sense. I don't know how I can feel like I'm helping if me building an aqueduct isn't going to give me health points, is age points. I don't know. Because the health part of it is still too abstract to really think about that being as the cause of the Dark Ages or Golden Ages.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing, too, is the lack of housing in one city in Civ 6 does not, like, spread to other cities. So, again, it's so abstract, but also abstracted to the point where, like, you don't have the sort of consequences that you would expect from having really unhealthy cities. Because if you have a really unhealthy city, you know, you would expect people to be spreading disease, and that disease would be following trade routes, and it would be going with military units, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And that's just not at all implemented in Civ 6. And, you know, was implemented a little bit in Civ 4, but, you know, still with, like, that one level of abstraction. Because I think in Civ 4, having a particularly unhealthy city would, like, actually reduce the health of nearby cities. It's too bad Phil had to step away. He probably would be able to answer that.
But also, having your unhealthy cities have a trade route to another empire didn't make that other city on the receiving end less healthy, which, if it was an actual plague-type thing, that would have happened.
Yeah, you could hypothetically weaponize it.
Yeah, and then you would have people closing your borders to you because they don't want to get it.
Has anybody played Rise and Fall Plague scenario?
I played the Rise and Fall mod for Civ 4, I think, but is that the one you're talking about?
No, I mean, no, the mod that is part of the scenario that's part of Civilization VI Rise.
Oh, okay. No, I have not.
I haven't either. I wondered, I haven't seen how they handle the plague mechanic. I would imagine it would have to be less severe than that, because it's not that the same scope of storyline, given that the scenario exists only as part of a short time period. But however they handle it might be interesting.
Yeah, good point. I forgot that even existed.
But Rise and Fall of Civilization back in Civ 4 did have an plague mechanic.
Yeah, I lost
just kind
games.
Of spread.
Yeah, I lost games because plagues swept through my civilization, like reduced all my cities to one population.
Well, the trick with them was you always whipped your cities down to low pop because you were going to lose the population.
Yeah.
That way you could still get stuff built, not lose all of.
Yeah, plagues and just health in general is something that I do definitely think that Civ 5 and Civ 6 really dropped the ball on. It kind of goes into just the larger lack of having to really manage your empire internally. And Civ 6 is a little bit better in that regard than Civ 5 was. But yeah, Civ 5 had like almost no empire management stuff at all. It was you build buildings in your cities, and then you stop every now and then to pick a social policy, and like that was it. Like at least Civ 6 has like the policy cards and district placement and stuff like that. But like actually having to keep your population happy and healthy, like has just never really been a large focus of the Civilization games. Like with maybe Civ 4 being the one exception.
Depending how far Civ 7 is in development, which probably development has been since Gathering Storm, I would imagine that the experience with COVID would probably change that.
Yeah, it very well might.
Because it's now a part of the public consciousness that public health is a problem.
Right, and considering that the Gathering Storm expansion, you know, took climate change so much more seriously than previous Civilization games had, based largely in part because of its prevalence in the popular culture, I would not be surprised if we do see some kind of, you know, substantial health and or disease slash pandemic mechanics implemented in Civilization VII when it, you know, eventually comes out.
Does anybody have a prediction on when it comes out? I say next year.
I would lean more towards Firaxis doing, like, a different IP and then coming back to civilization after that, because that kind of was what they did between Civ 5 and Civ 6. They did, you know, Beyond Earth for a few years.
Yes, but they also... Go ahead.
I was going to say they might even want to do another pass type thing, because the Frontier Pass has worked out really well, as opposed to, you know, the proper full standalone DLC expansion type thing, and take a little extra time to work on Civ 7.
I was thinking that maybe New Frontiers Pass was the stand-in for a Beyond Earth this time, where...
Possibly.
Because it's very clear that the amount of people working on Frontier Pass is less than the total amount working on an expansion pack. So I suspect the team is already split.
It's possible.
But that's okay, because it's worked out fine, but...
Yeah, so, and they may do a shorter, like, 6 month pass or something if they're coming up on Civ 7's release date, just to keep us somewhat entertained until then, instead of having that long, dry gap like we had between Civ 6, or Civ 5 and Civ 6.
Well, the nice thing about that long period between the Civ releases is you have more of an opportunity to actually, for lack of a better word, finish the previous Civ game, because one of the problems that I would have with them doing another... you know, season pass, like, right up until the release of Civilization VII, is you'd be like, well, no, but I'm still playing Civ VI. I don't want Civ VII yet.
Sure, we need at least somewhat of a break before it, but, you know, just depends on what they're having to go on with their staffing and everything, whether they can fully do it.
It also, I guess, depends on what the people voted for in that poll we had.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, in terms of like, real-world ideas that haven't historically been in Civilization games, one of the big ones for me has been the idea of, like, colonialism, like, the idea of having to expand to acquire more resources. And I feel like that's always been something that Civ hasn't really done particularly well, in large part because you don't really exhaust the resources that you have, so there's very little pressure to acquire more. You know, once you have a couple, like, for example, iron mines in your empire, you don't really need to acquire more iron, right? Because once you've got those iron units built, you're not even really using it anymore. You just stockpile it and then sell it to other leaders for cash. So there's never really been a huge incentive in the Civilization games to actually go and, you know, explore and expand and colonize new parts of the world in order to get new resources. And I would like to see the games putting a little bit more pressure on the civilizations to do that.
I disagree with that one, because we had resource depletion once, and it sucked massively. Did you ever play Civ 3?
I did.
Not fun when you're resource depleted.
Well, it comes back again to, you know, to people complaining about, like, the natural disasters. And, you know, there was, when Gathering Storm was announced, there was the knee-jerk reaction that, oh, no, we don't want more random disasters just destroying stuff like what we had in Civ 4 Beyond the Sword. So it all comes down to implementation, right? Like, what are the strategic... You know, you have to have strategic play associated with it. Like, I'm imagining, like, a system where, like, you have the option to, you know, drive your resources into the ground or, you know, consume them a little bit more sustainably. And then if you do use more of them, then you're going to run out, you know, more quickly. And if you use them sustainably, then you have them for the entire game, but you just don't get as much benefit from them. So there'd be trade-offs. And then if you go with the route of consuming them... you know, it's kind of similar to, like, chopping woods. You know, once you've chopped all the woods around your civilization, you don't have that resource anymore. And that's really the only area where I feel like civilization does that. So, you know, you could have, like, each resource having a bucket, right, a supply of it. And once you've exhausted it, it's gone. So you know how much is there, and you can strategize around it. And it's not just one turn, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you had niter, and now you don't have niter anymore. Because I agree, that's not particularly good strategy game design. But if you actually have some perceivable consequence behind it, and you can plan around it, then I think there's room in the game for something like that.
I guess. I just wouldn't like it. I
Yeah, and I imagine there's a lot of players who probably wouldn't, and like I said, I think there would just be a lot of knee-jerk reaction because people have bad memories of Civ 3 and, you know, maybe other games where that sort of thing happens.
Civ 3 had a lot of other problems, too.
Yeah, Civ 3 is, I think, widely regarded as the bad Civilization entry.
I think. Except by people who don't actually game.
Yeah, it was the one that I started with, so it got me hooked on Civilization, but, you know, to be fair, like, Civ 4 came out, like, the next year, so I got Civ 4 and I never had to look back.
That's the exact thing that happened. I bought Civ 3, and I played it for a while. Never managed to make it to the modern era, because I was just a kid. And then Civ 4 came out, and I was like, hey, this looks better, and it's more fun.
Yeah. Instead. And it was.
And I lost my first Settler game to Hatshepsut Space Race. That was pretty embarrassing looking back on it.
I won an accidental culture victory in my first Civ 4 game. Also embarrassing. How could I win culture?
You of all people. What are you doing with a culture, Phil?
I didn't know any better yet.
I do have to say, though, that this corporations mechanic in the Civ 6 Frontiers pass does look like it goes a little bit of the way towards addressing what I had just said, where there actually is a gameplay incentive to acquire more of even the same resources. So, you know, it does give you that that slight pressure, and it does it through, you know, positive reinforcement as opposed to the negative reinforcement of, you know, consuming the stuff you already have.
Positive reinforcement. Better. But another thing that is one thing that is a historical concept that is not put in the game, and it's probably better not. It's like population migration. Because
population what? You broke up a little bit.
Migration.
Yeah, that would be really tilting.
That would be like, oh, your population is running away from you because you can't do anything because you have no resources. That sucks. There's nothing you can do about that. Well, that's really fun.
That is one of those cases where realism is not too fun.
So yes, Phil, we were just talking about the thread about the real-life historic concepts that are not in Civ, and I think Maki suggested, was it Maki or Canis that suggested pandemics?
That was
a mutual suggestion, because we both thought of it.
Okay, yeah. That's why I couldn't remember which of you it was. So yeah, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think that's tough on the timescale of Civ. Like, to do any type of interaction like that, you're always going to have to somewhat gut reality. And I think we should fix sieges first, as in they should matter more, but that's just me.
Well, was there anything else that that you think is a historical concept that is sorely lacking from the Civ franchise?
I mean, there's probably a good list of things I could come up with that would maybe not make sense in the context of the Civ 6 turn-based strategy setup, where you advance a lot of turns per year, and you're forced by just the setup of the game's design to abstract to the point where you wouldn't be able to accurately model them anyway. So it's, like, I would need to really think carefully about how I would add something that the game is lacking, rather than just acknowledging that it's lacking. Like, a good example of that is supply, for just as a one-off example. Like, the game more or less doesn't touch on supply, very minimally, in that you heal more in friendly territory than hostile territory. But that might be good enough.
Well, there is.
Because of how much it varies by, in actual history, it varies by, you know, what period of warfare we're talking about.
There is also the combat penalty from having negative strategic resources in Civ 6.
Yeah, I guess. That's true. We rarely see it, but that is a thing.
Hey, if it's accessible, I usually try to, you know, send a mounted unit into enemy territory to pillage their strategic resources in the hopes that I can cause their other units to have a combat penalty. It's almost always a suicide mission because of the, you know, bombardment from cities going through, but...
Yeah. That's,
can you fix that, please?
Yeah, that's something that definitely shouldn't be a thing in the game, and is way off kilter from history.
Yeah, the fact that you can't do cavalry raids, even though cavalry raids historically were very successful and were used for thousands of years.
And the strength of cities without an army is just ridiculous. Just ridiculous. You build a wall and all of a sudden you have the same amount of military power projection as really heavy investment in the army. As long as something is somewhat near it, it's ridiculous. And yeah, it does take away the threat of being pillaged, which was a major threat historically. So yeah, I mean, that's something that you not implement well.
Maybe we can solve two birds with one stone and add some kind of supply mechanic, and the solution to that is to pillage enemy territory, so that there's an incentive to do that, and then also make cities weaker so that there's is actually viable to pillage their territory.
The problem is, how do you manage supply as the game goes on? Because it was very different in classical and medieval, and then especially in, once you get to World War II times, the way supply is handled is so different.
Yeah.
And yet, in Civ 6, supply would probably be the most trivial in World War II times, which is the opposite of history, just because you have tanks that move so quickly that you can just take a city per turn, and then it's your city.
Well, just taking Civ 6 mechanics, like, I have this idea, you know, and I'm just spitballing here, but maybe you attach a trade route to a general, and then the trade route moves back and forth between your territory with the general, and then is therefore open to being pillaged or plundered by the enemy. But, and not having that trade route there, either having the trade route provides you a bonus for having supply, or not having it provides you a penalty for not having supply, or possibly both.
Hmm.
And then you have something that you don't have to micromanage, right? Because you just attach it to the general, and
you'd have to be able to attach it to any unit, I think.
Maybe,
or
you might have
to push it off in.
Or you would have to change the way that generals work so that generals are easier to come by and not monopolized by a single civilization, so that only that civilization ever has supply.
Yeah. Well, you like if you don't attach the supply route to something, then you just can't move your army out of your borders. Like, yeah, you'd have to have some mechanic for supplying troops outside your borders that don't have a general.
Yeah, and Civ 6 currently has it has the supply convoy unit that's available late in the game, which is an upgrade to what the heck is the earlier version? The medic? And is there something earlier than the medic? I don't think so. So you could do something like that where those units are more important to a successful army.
Like a supply train?
Yeah. And maybe, like I said, it's maybe instead of it being one of your trade units, maybe it actually is specifically a military convoy unit, but it functions similarly to a trade unit in that it moves back and forth between your army and your cities, and is therefore open to being plundered by the enemy.
It could work. It's just one of those things that it feels like you can go too far into the weeds of tactics with a particular mechanical consideration.
Yeah. And I also don't think that something like that works particularly well unless you do start changing the scale of the map so that there's more distance between cities and more open terrain.
Yeah.
Especially if cities are, you know, blocking movement and doing zone of control and having bombardment. Again, it's just so impractical to send even a cavalry unit in behind enemy lines to do something like plunder a trade route, even if it is there for the taking, because it's just so easily defended. But then you don't want to go the complete opposite direction where you have to, like, leave a defending unit on every single tile that the caravan's going to cross over because it's too easy to get pillaged.
Yeah, and you would also have to have some way of tracing their out, because otherwise the game's automatic path of supply could be really stupid in some cases. Like passing through stuff that isn't your civilization, which would make no sense, or passing through really rough terrain that would be difficult to move into to protect it, which again wouldn't make sense, because how are supplies getting through that?
Yeah, at the very least, it should follow roads.
Yeah, ideally, but like, this is the kind of thing that's difficult to get the game to do right unless you just let the player control it, but now you have another point of inputs per turn that can go sour.
Right.
And you just have to update it all the time.
Yeah, and ideally we don't want even more micromanagement with our armies.
That is probably why some of the stuff we talked about earlier was more abstracted in Civ 6 and Civ 5, because managing the health was more micromanagement in Civ 4, so...
I guess. That was pretty non-interactive generally, though.
Yeah, I mean, it was basically build an aqueduct when it's available, and then build a hospital when it's available, and that's... It didn't go much beyond
resources.
That. Which we're doing in Civ 6 anyway.
Make sure you have diverse resources, that kind of thing, but still.
Yeah, just expand more.
Expand more.
Yeah, which again goes into the idea that I talked about, which is, you know, giving the player more reason to have to expand and acquire new resources and materials.
I think Civ 6 is at a decent place when it comes to attractiveness to expand.
It is, in that it does not outright punish you for doing so, as Civ 5 did.
And it's strictly better. Like, you get more stuff when you do it.
Right, but not
and,
in the...
And there are some, like, modest challenges with that as well.
And it's not in, like,
it's
the
super... Probably, like,
yeah, it's
attractive.
It's not in the super cheesy way that, like, Civ 5 Vanilla was, where, like, every city generated, what was it, 2 science and 2 gold in the city center. So you just plop the city on every tile that could possibly have a city, and then not even worry about building buildings or developing population, because it was just free gold and science.
Well, there was also, like, empire-wide modifiers that it were per city that you could get, like in Liberty and such.
Right.
So, just having a city was pretty valuable initially.
But then Civ 6 or Civ 5 overcorrected, I think, in the opposite direction, where it was, all right, I built my 4th city, I am done.
Yep, can't go on or you won't have any science, so you lose.
Right.
No Y for you, only call.
And even then, like, even when you're conquering, like, you had to raise everything, because you didn't want to annex them, and, you know, the client cities kind of sucked.
Yeah.
So Civ 6 is definitely better in that regard.
Yeah, do not miss Civ 5's ham-fisted way of blocking civilizations from expanding.
Were there any good ideas in the thread?
There's a lot of complaining about Europe in the...
Oh, yeah, the thread devolves into, like, Eurocentrism, arguing almost immediately, and that's not worth our time.
Yeah, kind of on that topic, though, one of the things that I've considered in the past is just, like, different civs from different parts of the world just having their own completely unique tech trees, you know, tech and civic trees.
That's cool, but that is extremely difficult to implement well
and,
from
yeah,
a design standpoint.
You have, like, examples like where, what was it, the Inca, you know, never invented the wheel, right? They just used pack animals for everything.
Like, you might as well be asking Advice to, like, do a one-handed handstand and then do push-ups while upside down. Like,
well, again, it's something that other games have done, but it's, you know, they're always games that are on different scales. Like, you go to the Paradox
Yeah, there's,
game,
like,
is,
3 to 5 of them or something.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, you go to, like, Crusader Kings 3, and you have, like, unique... text or whatever for each culture. Each religion has its own little upgrade tree.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you don't change the text tree that much between civs, like you have a lot of common things, then you could pull it off a little bit more feasibly.
Yeah, I'm not saying that, like, every single tech on the tree has to be unique for each civilization, but, you know, like, having them in different orders, you know, or having a few unique techs that are unique to that civ specifically.
Yeah. Yeah, that could work.
And it would probably be really easy if you did have, like, unique techs in civ's tech tree, but they're all, like, leaf techs, right? So they're not really even prerequisites for anything. I mean, that would probably not be hard at all. Like, it'd basically just be like you stick the unique unit or whatever on a unique tech, you know, hopefully along with some other bonuses that tie in.
Yeah, but now that's a nerf to that unit because you need to research an extra attack, unless it's, like, frickin' amazing.
Yeah, maybe. But, you know, we're just spitballing ideas here.
Like, I like the idea of just a straight-up different progression but it would be, I feel like that would be infeasible to implement in a game with so many different civilizations. But
yeah, which is why I suggested...
It is a cool idea.
Which is why I suggested that it being more like a regional thing. Like, so it's not necessarily every civilization has a unique tech tree, but civs from different parts of the world would have, you know, their own, you know, kind of cultural variations. And that way, not every civ in the game is following that Eurocentric, you know, tech progression, you know, through the same eras and all that.
And then your unit has 20 less strength and you get stomped. Because your next unlock is later by too much. Well.
Yeah, I mean, you have to move around, like, units and stuff like that and rebalance units so that this different civs are competitive with each other. You know, like, you wouldn't want, like, China being able to develop gunpowder in the classical era or something like that and suddenly having musketmen two eras before everyone else just because. But, you know, you can have that unlock, like, their, you know, like a, you know, siege unit or whatever or something that is scaled to that time period of the game.
Okay.
No magic.
Thank you for joining us, Polycast episode 377. I'm the VN team, and as usual, is joined by fellow co-hosts, Janice Alvinus.
Someday I'll get over this.
Makalua.
Someday I'll leave with dead air before Hughes.
And Mega Bears fan.
All right, now to dive into my backlog of video games.
I recommend Greedfall.
Can you keep up with what I'm doing now?
Copyright Civilization 3. Wait, that's not right. Let's try this again. Sound clips from Civilization 4, 3, 5, Beyond Earth, and 6, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright the Polycast at thepolycast.net.